from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. Yoga is extremely popular, especially here in the Bay Area. Many say it brings all kinds of benefits: better posture, more mobility and flexibility, even a better sex life and spiritual tranquility. But a recent New York Times article points to another kind of result: injuries, ranging from strained shoulders and torn cartilage to herniated discs, even stroke. We'll talk with a respected yoga teacher and the editor of Yoga Journal, among others, and we'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome once again to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. And this hour, a topic I suspect is going to arouse a lot of passion: yoga. It's extremely popular, especially here in the Bay Area. And most who practice will happily tell you about the physical, mental, and spiritual benefits of the practice. But a recent article in the New York Times is spotlighting another aspect. It's titled "How Yoga Can Wreck Your Body," and it describes a range of injuries resulting from yoga: strained knees and shoulders, hip and back problems, and in extreme and rare cases, stroke. So we thought today would be a good day to tackle the topic because the Yoga Journal National Conference kicks off today and runs through the weekend here in San Francisco. And with us this hour, Caitlin Quisgard, who's editor-in-chief of Yoga Journal. Good morning. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Jason Crandall, who is a yoga teacher, a contributing editor of Yoga Journal. Jason, good to have you as well.
Likewise. Thank you.
And Baxter Bell, also in the studio. He's the director of the Piedmont Yoga Studio's teacher training program over in Oakland. Good morning.
Good to see you. Thanks.
And joining us by phone, Moshe Lewis. He's a physical medicine and rehab physician at California Pacific Medical Center. Good to have you as well, Dr. Lewis.
Good morning.
Well, let me begin with this article, which was posted on the New York Times about a week ago, written by William Broad, I believe is his name, or Broad, perhaps. It attracted a lot of comments on the New York Times website, more than 700. And Caitlin Quisgard, first of all, I know we haven't not everyone has read the article, but what is your impression of it, and what reaction have you been getting?
Well, in reading it, just as a journalist as well as a yoga practitioner, one of the things that I noticed is a lot of the examples are really old. He cites case studies from the 1970s to talk about people experiencing stroke during practice, and uses statistics. I think 2002 is the last year he has statistics for the number of emergency room visits caused by yoga practice, which is 46 in the U.S., which, you know, with the millions of people practicing, is not a huge number. So in a lot of ways, the fact that there is a significant lack of current statistics, examples, case studies, begs the question, is that, you know, do you have to dig back to the 1970s to find someone who had a stroke?
And clearly there weren't, as I said, there weren't a lot, but there were some. And I guess you could also argue that, you know, people get hit while they're riding their bikes. I mean,
exactly.
Anytime you're doing physical activity, there are risks. Baxter Bell, what do you tell teachers that you're training to avoid some of the problems that are, you know, described in that article?
Sure. Well, one of the things I do is I actually have sessions where we actually go through specific injuries that can arise in yoga and how to address them when they are present, and also how to try and prevent them. In other words, how to look at the structure of a pose, a given asana, and approach it intelligently with your understanding of anatomy and physiology, and adapt it for individual students in the classroom.
And when you say an asana, you mean, is that a...
The individual postures in yoga known as the asanas. So, you know, we have to remember that although oftentimes contemporary yogis are going to a public class in a studio where there could be 15 to 30 other people in class, an experienced adept teacher will start to get the skills to be able to address individual needs to lessen the chance of injury over time.
I noticed that I'm particularly aware of my posture as you're talking. I need to sit up. Jason, yes. I took a class with you.
Yes.
Good to see you. There's been such a proliferation of yoga. It's so popular, especially here in the Bay Area, but across the country, what, 5-6 million people doing yoga now?
More like 15 million.
I'm sorry, it's the six number. It's a $6 billion industry, I think, when you include all the money spent. How has that proliferation affected, do you think, the quality of the teaching?
Well, I think that the proliferation of the total number of participants coming to the yoga practice, it requires that yoga practitioners and that yoga teachers specifically become more skillful and adept at addressing and working with large numbers of people. So, for example, early on when I first started teaching in the late 90s, there would be maybe 8 to 10 people in class. Now, for a handful of circumstances, there's closer to 30 or 50 people in class. So I have to be better and better, and many teachers have to be better and better at dealing with larger number of students coming in with more pre-existing injuries. So as a teacher, we have to be more skillful and more insightful with working with more people with more issues.
So less than ideal. I mean, just as it is with K through 12, you'd rather have 20 students than 30 or 40.
Well, there's a lot of different ways in which people practice yoga. One way in which people practice yoga is public classes. And there are, as I just said, there are more people attending more public classes. That being said, there's also small group sessions. There's also individual sessions. There's also weekend workshop sessions. So people can find within the market pretty easily a higher teacher to student ratio. But I also want to say that even though there are more people participating in class, and as you say, that could potentially be less than ideal, I think that the average level of education amongst yoga teachers has increased, and our awareness of injuries have increased. And I think the incidence of hubris have decreased.
Hubris among teachers or
students?
Yeah,
both. I think that teachers are more and more aware of pre-existing injuries and more skillful and more trained at helping people manage those injuries, and also giving a good, proper context in every yoga class by encouraging students to listen to their body, to back off, to not push through pain, and to become more skillful at otherwise listening to the sensations that are arising and responding appropriately.
I want to bring Moshe Lewis into the conversation. You are a physician, rehab physician. How frequently do you see people who either have gotten benefit from yoga as a therapeutic method or those who have come because they have been injured doing yoga?
Sure. I see a combination of both. Way more patients that benefit from yoga than not, and I thus feel very comfortable selecting who to refer to yoga because I really like it as an ongoing maintenance of essentially therapy once they've finished a more specific course that's one-on-one. I think yoga is a great transitional exercise modality.
And is there a caveat to that at all?
Right. The caveat, and I think everybody has hinted at that in their conversation thus far, is really becoming more adept at who may be injured. And to be even more specific, it's people that may have radiating pain, sciatica-type pain, we call it for the legs, but it also can occur in the arms. That certainly can be one of those key caveats for me for any significant manipulation in the spine. And the spine is just one of those areas that just seems more commonly affected as individuals get older.
Baxter Bell.
Yeah, one of the hats that I wear in addition to being a yoga teacher and an educator is that for 11 years I was a full-time family physician, and now I continue to practice medicine in a complementary medicine setting. And, you know, when someone comes into my office with an injury, I'm not necessarily looking for the one factor that caused the injury, but I realize there are many factors that play into what happens. And I think one of the difficulties with our article from the New York Times is the author implies in some way that the yoga practice is the source of all the injuries cited. And I think that's just irresponsible in some ways. And we have to realize that one's age, One's level of fitness, one's knowledge of one's own body and space, if you've had other physical practice you've participated in, previous injuries, as Jason alluded to as well. All these things are going to be factors, as well as other factors that you have to consider. Now, do I expect my teachers to be diagnosticians? No, I don't. But one of the other things that I tell them in our training sessions is the first thing you ought to say when you greet a new student is, "Hi, my name's Baxter. What's your name? Do you have any injuries or health conditions that I should be aware of?"
And if they say yes, and then, you know, they describe it, then what then? What does the teacher do?
So then you have the choice of saying, "I'm fairly comfortable with providing modifications for you," or being frank and honest and saying, "You know, I don't know exactly how to deal with that. We're going to be doing certain poses that could pose a risk for you today. This might not be the great class for you today. You might want to come back when I'm doing my back care restorative class on Wednesday afternoons." So, you know, you have a couple of choices to make there. And it's not always easy for a new teacher in particular who's trying to build up clientele and get their business going to do this sort of thing.
And Dr. Lewis, did you say that you see a lot of yoga instructors with injuries?
Right. I tend to have a biased population where patients are a bit older, and certainly now two people, Baxter's mentioned age as well, and that is definitely a factor because we know that changes in the spine are starting to occur probably mid to late 30s almost ubiquitously. So as my instructors get into their late 40s and 50s, many of them have issues that start to arise and still want to be able to teach. So we really work closely to try to augment their capabilities as well.
We're talking this hour about yoga, the benefits of which there are many, and the risks of which there may be some as well, kind of riffing off a New York Times article that's gotten a lot of attention. It's titled "How Yoga Can Wreck Your Body." There's also a Yoga Journal conference in San Francisco this week. And I suspect our listeners may have something to say about this, so let's open the phone lines a little early. 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org. Jason, in terms of teachers, what is the standard for certification? I mean, if you go to a class in one of these public settings, what expectation can a student have in terms of what kind of certification the teacher has and training?
Sure. In the marketing collateral for any studio, you're going to have teacher bios. This is pretty standard across the board. So the yoga student can pretty easily look at different teachers and their background and their qualifications. And there are a couple baseline levels of qualifications. There are typically 200-hour certifications or 500-hour certifications. And those go through an independent certifying body called Yoga Alliance, which has become more or less the industry standard. And you'll also find that the vast majority of teachers with those levels of baseline certification have ongoing continuing study with teachers in all sorts of different modalities. The other thing that this brings to mind, though, is that if you look at any subject matter, you find that creating standards doesn't necessarily mean that everyone that graduates with those standards is going to have the same level of skill or same level of competence or deliver the subject with the same level of voice. And so it's incumbent upon the participants, the yoga students, to make sure that they don't just check out the baseline level of certification, but that the teacher that they are going to feels appropriate to them.
And so it's sort of a gut feeling as well as whether you enjoyed the class and so on.
Yeah,
and
well, I think it's a handful of things. It's a gut feeling. It's whether or not you enjoyed the class. It's whether or not that teacher had an overriding contextualization that, hey, you're welcome to challenge yourself at various intervals if that feels appropriate to you, but it's even more important that you learn to pay attention to the sensations from your body and modify accordingly, especially if there's any sharp or local discomfort.
That's Jason Crandall, a yoga teacher here in the San Francisco Bay Area, contributing editor of Yoga Journal. He's with us for the hour along with Baxter Bell, who's director of the Piedmont Yoga Studios Teacher Training Program. Also here, Caitlin Quisgard, editor-in-chief of Yoga Journal, and joining us by phone, Moshe Lewis, who is a physician and a rehab physician at that at California Pacific Medical Center. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. You know, I happened to be yesterday in Whole Foods, and at the checkout found one of these nice glossy posters or postcards for the Yoga Journal conference. And I was struck by the picture, which is, I don't know who that is, but it's a black and white photo of a woman doing a yoga pose. She is standing on her feet, bending over backwards, resting with her right palm flat on the ground, her left hand on her chest, and she's smiling. I think if I tried to do that, I wouldn't be smiling.
Yeah, for what it's worth, neither would the three of us in this room.
So I'm wondering, you know, this is marketing.
Right.
You're marketing a conference, but you're marketing yoga. And, you know, I look at this and I see health. I see flexibility. What do you see?
Well, I think you also see aspiration to not necessarily do exactly what she's doing. As Jason says, you know, even those of us, I've been practicing for close to 30 years. I mean, I could never get close to that. She has natural flexibility and she probably practices for hours a day rather than sitting at a desk and working like most of us do. But the difference between the images, like the aspirational images, and part of when you noticed her smile, that is it. It's like if you're a practitioner who's been at it for a while, who does practice backbends, who is interested in advancing their practice, and you see someone capable of something that's absolutely beautiful. I mean, her pose is gorgeous. Her alignment is perfect. She's smiling. She's radiating, you know, joy at what she's doing. It's capturing the essence, the feeling. It's not saying, come and, you know, we'll turn you upside down.
This,
and
right.
Yeah, crack your bones to get you there. Yeah. That's not what we're intending.
But let me, Baxter Bell, let me ask you about another aspect of this kind of marketing, ego. You know, you come into a class, maybe you know some of the folks in the class, maybe you're a complete stranger, you're sitting next to people who are doing these poses, everyone's at some different level, it may be an introductory or an intermediate class, whatever. You have to guard against A, doing exactly what the teacher is doing necessarily or the person next to you. I mean, how do you guard against that and how important is that?
Sure. Well, you know, I think teachers, if they're skilled, make comments in class that clearly present to you the option of different ways of doing the same pose so that you don't have to feel compelled to do this advanced variation if it's your first time in class. I taught class last night. I had 30 students in class. One of them had never taken yoga ever before. Actually, I take that back. He'd been to class one other time. And he left that first class feeling like there was a joke that everybody got except for him, because the first class did not make him feel included in the process. And I think we have to take note that these are poses, but that yoga is a process. You enter into this practice like you did a 12-week course. You didn't just go for one day to learn how to do triangle pose. You signed up so you could experience the process of yoga asana or yoga postures. So I think we have to get that message across as well. Give options. All yoga poses are not created equal. Some of them are appropriate for many people, and many poses are not appropriate for many people, and you have to be, like this woman, very advanced in her ability to backbend. And even then, she could still hurt herself. You know, that's the problem. You know.
Jason, what would you add to that?
Well, I think something immediately comes to mind, which is that pose is perfectly appropriate for that practitioner doing it that way. It's a really skillful pose. Now, if anyone in this room thought because someone else can do that pose, well, by golly, I have to be able to do that pose. Well, that's our mistake, right? That's our mistake. And as a yoga teacher, I can do my best to make the overriding context of class such that I'm not impelling students to go beyond their current or their possible ranges. I have to be very good, and other teachers have to be good at setting the end game. Like, what is the end game? Doing a hard pose or taking care of yourself? Well, the end game is taking care of yourself. And the vast majority of teachers are going to convey that, I think, pretty skillfully. The last thing that comes to mind is if I were to look at Runner's World magazine and look at a marathon runner, well, that doesn't mean that I can't run just because I'm not a marathon runner. It means I need to be specific and appropriate with how I approach it, given who I am.
Find the right level.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. Lou is on the line. Good morning. Lou, you're on. Good morning. Yeah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
Good. I wanted to say I've been doing yoga for about 20 years, various styles. I've done Iyengar. I've done Bikram. And I've gotten so much out of them, but I have sustained quite a few injuries over the years due to me pushing it too far. And I want to say that that's actually an important part of the practice for me, is that recognizing injuries has actually been a really important mental, emotional, and physical thing to work against. And I think it's a really important thing to actually get injured so that you can avoid a lot of the traps of pushing yourself too hard. Bikram, in general, I've gotten so much out of, I have to say, a lot of the teachers in Bikram are less likely to tell you to back off and be, if anything, they're going to push you a little bit harder.
And just briefly describe what Bikram is.
Bikram Choudhury is a yogi who's taught a, for lack of a better word, kind of a fast food version of yoga, which is, I think, 26 postures that are taught the same way and taught by teachers who go through training and that he gives in Los Angeles. There's a script that all the teachers use.
Yeah. Okay. They just want to get an idea, and you're doing it in a warm room, right? A hot
room.
Yeah,
a very warm room.
Yeah. Okay. So, Dr. Lewis, let me just ask you to respond to that point that, you know, getting injured is a good thing because you, and I realize that's somewhat tongue in cheek, but you have to know what your limits are.
Right. Well, we used to espouse a little bit more to the no pain, no gain philosophy, heralded back in the 70s than we do now. But I do think the caller's point is taken, that really trying to define where that limit of extensibility can go, stretching, and then also counter it with strengthening is a very fine art. And in his case, for him, that injury helped make him a bit more aware. I heard comments like, you take that pregnant pause, you take the extra moment to really try to assess, or that gut feeling that you referred to, that really defining that more specifically, and certainly, as the doctor pointed out, age is one of those factors. We know that as our bodies are changing with time, there may be a reluctance to admit the fact that, gosh, this really actually hurts.
Right.
And admitting that doesn't mean that we're mortal. It defines the fact that something's going on, and maybe it is appropriate to back off.
All right, Lou, thanks for the call. We have a web comment here which sort of plays on this, and we're short on time, but Baxter Bell, quick comment. The author writes here, I'm a yoga amateur, but it seems like there are so many different styles it would be hard to generalize. All yoga is bad for you. Are some styles better or worse than others?
It's a great question. Yeah, you know, Yoga Journal publishes, and it's probably up on the website right now, a nice little guide to the different styles of yoga that are taught in the Bay Area and around the country. And there are styles that are going to be more appropriate for certain age groups and fitness level folks out there, and others that are going to be less so. So I think, you know, it behooves you to take a look at what's available in the literature that you can find online, talk to teachers, ask them about the different styles, and make a good educated decision for yourself about what's going to work best for you.
And we'll come back, maybe talk a little bit more about that, maybe get some specifics. We're going to continue this hour talking about yoga, the pros and cons of it. Our number here, if you want to join the conversation, 866-733-6786. And as always, you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org or leave a comment on Facebook, Forum's Facebook page. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Lots more to talk about. Hope you stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today. In this hour, we're talking about yoga. Our guests, Baxter Bell, director of the Piedmont Yoga Studios Teacher Training Program over in the East Bay. Also, Caitlin Quisgard, she's editor-in-chief of the Yoga Journal. Jason Crandall, also here in the studio, a well-known yoga teacher, also a contributing editor of Yoga Journal. And joining us by phone, Dr. Moshe Lewis. He is a physical medicine and rehab physician at California Pacific Medical Center. Again, the number to dial this morning, 866. I guess nobody dials anymore. The number to push is 866-733-67. My mother would still dial if she had that option. She refuses to get an answering machine as well. 866-733-6786. So before the break, Baxter, we were talking about different styles of yoga. And you said that there are, you know, clearly some that are more appropriate than others, depending on who you are. Can you be just a little more specific without using too much lingo, if you would, or jargon?
Well, yeah, I think as Jason pointed out, you can look at bios online. You can also read descriptions of what typically takes place in a given class. So there are some general categories. There is often classes called gentle beginner level yoga. That sounds like a good place to start, probably. Then there are classes that are intermediate. There are flow classes in which there's almost continuous movement and are usually more athletically challenging for people. Then there are things called the Ashtanga Primary Series, which is quite physically demanding and can last up to 2 hours in length. So, you know, you're going to want to do a little research as you decide what's good for you. If you already have an injury, there are therapeutic classes out there. I teach a back care yoga class and have for 10 years, and people come in with usually back injuries unrelated to their yoga practice. A lot of them have never done yoga before, but that's where they want to start.
Yep. And I had a herniated disc in my neck, went to a yoga tree, Jason, took a class there for back and neck, and it was great. You know, it really is about figuring out. You do have to get some kind of a physiological. You have to be checked out too, and know what you're doing.
Yeah,
and you could make it worse.
I think there is also an important little point to make, which is that oftentimes what I'll see is a student. A very physically fit student who's never done yoga will come into an experience level class because there is an association made between level of fitness and ability to sustain a vigorous exercise and level of class. And so the difficult challenge within this is yoga is actually a set of skills. It is actually a set of skills. So just because someone is robust in their body and very well conditioned doesn't mean they're an advanced yoga practitioner. Just like if I can play the piano, it doesn't mean I can play the trombone.
Yeah. Or just because you can play the piano doesn't mean you can play, you know, Rachmaninoff, sit down and, you know, without notes or.
Exactly. Or, yeah. Exactly. So it is a set of skills that has to be learned from the beginning.
Let's go back to the phones now. Saul is on the line in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. You're on.
I'm doing good. Thank you.
Go ahead. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah. No, my comment is I got an injury. I've got a hip labral tear doing yoga.
Shoulder.
In 2009. So I'm just an example of someone who got injured. My issue is with the general yoga classes because people don't really know their level of skills to do yoga. In my case, I was in a class with a lot of advanced people, and I had only done 10 sessions when I got my injury. And there's so many factors involved, and my recommendation is that there are assessments done for each individual before they join these general class yogas, just like you do when you go to weight training classes where you have to go through an assessment when they look at your cardio level. They make you lift some weight so they can see your strength, and then they come up with a plan based on your capabilities.
Yeah. Is Baxter Bell, how common is that?
It's not as common as I would like it to be. And, you know, I went over to India a couple of years ago and studied at the Krishnamacharya Yoga Mandiram. And what's interesting about this training center is they work individually one-on-one with all the yoga students that come in. There are no public classes unless you're a teenager or younger. And so you come in and you get an assessment by a physician, actually checks you out, and then recommends for you to work with a specific therapist. He knows all the therapists on staff. So you work with a yoga therapist who then designs an individualized practice for you that takes into factor all different sorts of things going on in your life.
Yeah.
So that's happening in San Francisco, actually. Chase Bossert's group here in San Francisco,
Healing Yoga Foundation,
does that work very nicely. So it's starting to happen small. I hope it grows.
Yeah. Caitlin Quiskard, yoga is big business. I mentioned that. I think it was perhaps even in your publication I read that it's a $6 billion business nationwide, according to statistics from a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. How does that play into this whole equation? The popularity, the fact that it is marketed now. There's yoga studios, certainly in San Francisco, many of them. People are making money off it, which is not bad at all. But does it mean you need to be on guard a little bit about just exactly, you know, who you're buying your lessons, you know, which studio you're going to, what kind of classes you're taking, and so on?
Right. I don't know that the fact that it's big business means that you need to be more careful. I think that you have to take personal responsibility no matter what for where you choose to practice, who you choose to practice with. I think that you want to find a great teacher that works for you. And just hearkening back for a second to this question of levels and people signing themselves up for things that aren't quite right for them. I mean, I think one of the things is it's worth sampling things that are out there, and you can always back off. I mean, I think that teachers tend to say, you know, take a rest when you want to, and people don't tend to do it. But that's probably the best solution in the beginning
to back off a little.
Yeah, and to learn, like, sample all the studios, all the teachers that are of interest to you, but with some, you know, self-knowledge about what you're capable of.
And Jason, what about Yelp? I mean, you know, there's Yelp is big in the Bay Area, and I'm sure that there's Yelp for yoga.
Yelp is not where I would start. I have no problem with Yelp, but it's not the means by which I would look for a studio.
Yeah, how would you?
I'm more likely to look by word of mouth or through reputation. I feel like there are many studios and many yoga teachers out there for sure. And as Caitlin just said, it's just like I go to a lot of different restaurants. I've been to a lot of different restaurants in my life, and I continue to go back more frequently to ones that work well for me. And so it's incumbent upon participants to go to several different classes with several different studios and several different teachers and figure out what resonates best with them and feels most level appropriate to their experience.
Yeah.
Can I also just say that when you do that and you develop a relationship with your teacher, even if they're teaching 30 people, they know that you've come every Saturday. They start to recognize your face. They start to understand. They see your body. They know, you know, what your injury is or what you're prone to do. And you start getting the kind of individual guidance that you need by developing those relationships, just by showing up.
Sure. We mentioned at the top that the jumping off point for this discussion this hour is this article in the New York Times, How Yoga Can Wreck Your Body. And I want to bring in now the person who is prominently featured in that article, Glenn Black, who is a yoga instructor and joins us this morning. Glenn Black, good to have you with us.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
Let me ask you, the article, of course, very controversial among many things. It says, quotes you as saying, Black has come to believe that, quote, the vast majority of people should give up yoga altogether. It's simply too likely to cause harm. Is there anything about the article and the way your advice was portrayed that you disagree with or take issue with?
I don't take issue with anything that Mr. Broad said, because he's quoted me quite accurately. I find that most people that go into classes don't know their body very well. My suggestion to people is that they find somebody. It can be a yoga teacher or any other kind of body therapist that can really assess their body by going through ranges of motion, checking their strength versus stability, and then looking at it that way, and then you can really get a much better idea of what kind of class would be best for you.
But you're saying in that article that the vast majority of people should not be doing it altogether.
That's because I've been teaching for 40 years, and I see that, and plus I've been doing body work for longer than that, and there are very few people in the world that don't have one or more problems in their body. And by doing yoga, depending on the style, of course, some of it is very repetitious, some of it's very vigorous. And depending on whether or not how much you take care of yourself in the class, regardless of whether or not a teacher knows you or not, that teacher may not be able to really address your particular situation in a class that has 30 to 50 people in it.
Dr. Moshe Lewis, what would you say to Glenn Black? He is, of course, a very experienced teacher, but he is saying that yoga may not be right for most people who are doing it. You've said you actually think it can be quite therapeutic.
I do think it can be therapeutic. I think that we cited some of the instances where individual patients or participants are evaluated beforehand, before going in. And of course, that represents an ideal. One can see the continued emergence of private classes, very one-on-one assessments that are occurring, working one-on-one with an individual. And it's true, anytime something gains a tremendous amount of popularity, you may find that patients who are older are at increased risk. However, with exercise and sports becoming as popular and even more so in the U.S. because of the obesity epidemic, you're going to continue to find that people are going to go and do yoga, and that there aren't statistics that are hard that show in evidence literature that there is a significant number of specific injuries that are directly attributable to the actual practice of a yoga style. So without those types of numbers, doctors like myself who do those assessments, and sounds like some of the people on the forum also do as well, are going to feel comfortable when we send certain patients to yoga.
And Glenn Black, are you saying that do you believe that there are some particular poses or postures that are, you know, the cause of most of the problems that you believe are there?
Well, it was interesting in the piece that was done on NBC last night, the first part of the segment, they had people going through chaturangas, upward dog, downward facing dog pose, plank pose. And in my experience, I find many people getting shoulder problems and low back problems from doing that sequence over and over.
When you say over and over, do you mean as a teacher or as a student? And what does over and over mean?
Well, as a student, if you... There are certain schools of yoga which that's what you do. You are doing these sequences which include chaturangas, which are the plank pose and moving from upward dog pose to downward facing dog pose. And they're done very many times in one class.
Yeah.
If you already have a condition in your shoulder and you continue to do these things over and over again, you get the repetitive use syndrome.
Baxter Bell?
I observed this very early on in my teaching career as well, that a lot of students would come to my class, and they had been involved in these more vigorous flow-style classes in which you're doing this lowered push-up position into a back bend. And indeed, there was a higher incidence of shoulder injury in those folks. And so I started to think about how the sequences could be modified to reduce the impact on the shoulder joint. And in my classes, it's rare, if ever, that we actually do chaturanga anymore, specifically because of this. And I say that to my students. I, in a sense, warn them that repetitive movements like this could potentially lead to injury. And we've come up with a way that seems to work better for more students. And I think that, you know, as our level of sophistication improves over time as yoga teachers and yoga educators, I think the practice in many communities is going to look different than it does right now.
Yeah.
I hope it will.
Yeah, Jason, what would you add to that in terms of particular poses that you know, people should be cautious about?
Well, I'll pick up on the same pose. And what I want to say is that I am a teacher that actually includes these poses and quite a bit in my yoga classes. And anytime you use the body, not using the body is clearly not a very good option for health, right? Not participating in any type of exercise is clearly not a good option
being
for
well-being. Being a couch potato, not a good idea.
Right, that's really not a particularly good idea. So anytime you use the body in a repetitive way, it requires you to pay very skillful attention and to learn appropriate, proper technique and to listen to the signaling that your body is providing you and either take modifications or take rest entirely. And I think that one of the things that hasn't been spoken about is the pace, right? It's the are students moving at a pace that allows them to pay attention to what's happening in their body, execute skillful technique, and respond accordingly? And I think that virtually any physical thing done that isn't done skillfully or that isn't paid attention to can cause harm. But challenging things can also be done when done skillfully with a high level of attention. And that's incumbent upon all teachers to encourage and to actually teach how to do it.
Yeah. Glenn Beck, I want to say goodbye to you in a moment. Before I do, though, you have had some injuries yourself. If you could maybe just quickly describe those and how they're healing.
Yes. Well, I've been practicing for 40 years now, and I was always very flexible and always very strong. And I used to perform yoga flow postures, and I did very extreme back bends, and often they would be included with twists, and many of my ligaments in the lower back got overstretched, and because of that, I had a stenosis at the level of L3 and L4 in the lower back, and I had to have surgery to stabilize the vertebra, and it was two and a half years ago.
Yeah, and when you say very extreme right there, I would think that's dangerous.
It is dangerous. I thoroughly agree, but I had spent years preparing my body to do them, but it doesn't matter. Some of these poses, the more extreme ones, and especially these people who are flexible and who want to do these poses that are shown in the yoga books, they're really opening themselves up to the susceptibility of serious injury.
All right. Well, Glenn,
which I did.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us, and best of luck to you with healing from that. Let's go back to the phones. Gary is on the line in Oakland. Hi, Gary.
Hey, my name's Gary Crapso, and I've been in this field for 40 years. I started in 1974 in Madras with Krishnamacharya and his son, Deskachar. And I got a lot of letters after that article from friends who said, Gary, you've been saying that for decades. And I think that I just want to make two comments about it. One, the first comment, of course, is that yoga isn't about exercise. And the reductionism of yoga in the United States to postures is one of my pet peeves, although it's a part of the process. It's not the whole thing. But more importantly, relative to this particular discussion, it seems to me that the fundamental problem in the American yoga community is that people think that yoga practices about postures, and postures are tools that are positions you should master, rather than recognizing that postures are tools to help you get more in touch with your body and to create more integration, more stability, more range of motion, more ease in your body. So it's really not about the postures. It's about the practitioner, and teachers shouldn't be teaching postures. They should be teaching people and using the postures as tools to help the people get into more touch with what's actually happening in their body and create improvement.
Baxter Bell, you agree with that?
Oh, hear, hear. Thanks, Gary, for calling in. I really appreciate your addition to the discussion. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. And I think that's a message that has to be coming through over and over again in our classes. If we're going to work in group-sized classes, I think we have to find a way to connect to students as individuals and let them know this isn't about mastering Chaturanga Dandasanas or any other fancy Sanskrit name for a pose, but actually really learning what it is that they need right now and how that's going to best serve them as time goes on.
Can I interject something?
Yeah, sure. Kristen, go ahead.
A couple of things. Well, first of all, Gary is a master teacher mm-hmm. who just called in. And what he's basically suggesting is self-knowledge is what the yoga practice is ultimately teaching us, not muscle control or greater flexibility or how to get into that back bend, but how to move skillfully, not just on our mats, but in our life. I mean, that's what the practice is designed to do. And so going back to what Glenn Black said about not trusting ourselves to make our own assessment, but needing a medical assessment before we get on our mat, it's not that I disagree that you might, if you really are out of touch with your body, you might want someone else's guidance in helping you understand it. But the point of coming to your mat, the physical part of it is gaining that understanding of not just how your body works, which is incredibly important for doing the practice, but what your relationship is to it, whether you push yourself, et cetera. So I think that to give away our power in that to someone else and have them decide for us what we can and can't do is sort of counter to the practice.
Yeah. Gary, thanks very much for calling in. Jason, you know, I was looking at the website. Somebody actually, when they heard I was going to be doing the show, sent me a link to another article that was something like 10 reasons you should ignore the New York Times article. and I wonder, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, is there value in this article and the notion that, hey, there are some risks here?
I think that in all sincerity, it's a sensationalist-driven article. But are there some potential takeaways? Sure. I think that the overarching – I mean just with regards to the physical experience of yoga, there are some essential takeaways, which are that first and foremost, we should pay attention to what we're doing as we're doing it.
Teachers and practitioners.
Teachers and practitioners. And I don't think that is new information. Right. I mean, I don't think this is some groundbreaking new information that through a physical modality performed to an extreme, as he articulates, that we could create and cause damage. That seems to me a pretty baseline understanding. That being said, to continue as a yoga community to acknowledge that we need to pay deep attention to what we're doing as we're doing it. And that we need to work in a level specific way, I think is really essential. And there's one more layer that I think it's important to bring up, because some of the conversations earlier hinge on it. I played travel ice hockey for 15 years before I started doing yoga.
And there's no risks to that.
Zero risks. No, I'm not going to make a comparison. I love sports. I really love sports. I still to this day love sports. But the point that I want to make is, when I came to yoga, it was shocking to me that I was supposed to actually pay attention to the sensations of my body. I had trained myself
to ignore it.
To ignore it. I mean, that actually was my job, to ignore the feedback that my body was giving me to execute an externalized event. And so as a 20-year-old starting yoga and hearing the overall context of self-awareness and using the sensations as a focal point to engage skillfully with what you're engaging with was shocking. It was shocking that the body could be used as an asset, not just as a liability. And so there's a learning curve that a lot of new practitioners come to, because there aren't any environments that I'm aware of where we're taught to pay attention to the signaling that our body is giving us, and to not only pay attention to the signaling, but to use those as focal points for steadying the attention of the mind.
Baxter Bell, we've had a few emails from folks talking about the spiritual side of yoga. How is it different from just stretching? Like, what can you get out of it psychologically,
sure,
spiritually?
Sure. Well, and there's actually been some good research. The NIH has done several studies now looking at the benefits of meditation practices, which are sometimes considered part of the spiritual practice of yoga. And I think we have to expand our definition of yoga. We've been talking about poses and the physical aspect, but if yoga was an iceberg, that would be the tip of the iceberg, truly. And so if we look at the other practices, a lot of the other practices are about this relationship with oneself, getting to know oneself more deeply, which could be an aspect of spirituality. And so, yeah, yoga has that as a main component. It gets removed a lot of times in the West, you know, so that you can have yoga at the gym and at the Y that has no overtones of spirituality or connectedness to community and all these other qualities. But indeed, that is a part of the practice.
Let's see if we can get another call or two in. Kim is on the line in Novato. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Love the show. I've been practicing yoga for about 8 years. I had to take a little break, came back to it. I love the flow class that I'm totally dedicated to. You're right. Find the teacher. She really emphasizes what you said, you know, balance yourself to, you know, modify your poses. But she also emphasizes and starts each class, it's a flow class, with warming up the spine, doing gentle movements to warm the spine. She doesn't like the overarching back bend stuff. She really, really, really emphasizes modifications and breath with movement. And for me, it's kind of like I'm a scuba diver, and my favorite part of being underwater is I can hear my breath. And I think when I'm really doing yoga for myself, it's the breathing with movement that works the best for me.
Jason Crandall, that we haven't talked much about that, but that is, and there's even a way of breathing in yoga, as I recall from your class.
Well, there are many ways of breathing, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely. There are many ways of breathing. And I encourage in a very basic way, but I think basic things are accessible and often poignant, that in the yoga practice, we are endeavoring to bring the content of the mind, the experience of embodiment, and the experience of breathing all in the same room together at the same time, so that these various layers of who we are synced together. And when they're synced together, when our mind is tuned in to what our body and breath is doing, and we're responding appropriately and using the body's signals as focal points, it's a remarkable experience.
Getting to the end of the hour, before we wrap up, Dr. Lewis, I just want to come back to you. We started this hour talking about potential harm and injuries. What can you tell people, students, people thinking of yoga, what can they do to make sure that doesn't happen, that they get the most out of it without with the least potential risk?
Right. I think we've hinted at a lot of excellent elements here. Teachers that are doing assessments and really being able to get a sense as to where a participant may be coming in. Participants themselves being more aware. Several people have commented on that age is being a factor. And certainly we have to acknowledge that risk exists with any type of exercise that someone does. So I think the key steps for participants are to accept that while this is a excellent, phenomenal modality for strengthening one's mind and certainly stretching one's body, that really being able to pay attention to limitations that may exist. And many times people also being more self-aware and not unwilling to get a diagnosis.
Okay. Thanks very much. We're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Moshe Lewis, thanks so much for being with us. Thanks to all of you this hour, Baxter Bell, Caitlin Quisgard from Yoga Journal, Jason Crandall, and also earlier in the hour, Glenn Black. Forum is produced by Kevin Gilrey, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Howard Gelman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in for Michael Krasny. I'm going to go work on my posture. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.